Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Weekly Conservative Talk. I'm just plain Bill, and I've got the show for at least a little bit all by myself. So let's get right on into it. How many people today, I know primaries are going on, everybody wants to know about them, but how many today listen to Justice Breyer opine about the First Amendment? Anybody? Nobody? Everybody? Who knows? But here's what he had to say. What he said essentially was, if someone peripherally dies because someone did something under their First Amendment rights, then the Supreme Court really probably ought to take a look at that to see how far the First Amendment goes. And so what he essentially said was, if you oppose the burning of the flag, if you oppose art paid for by the government that denigrates, no, that's not a racial slur, folks, that denigrates Christianity, then as long as you go out and kill somebody over that, then by God, their First Amendment rights ought to be restricted. Now, he dressed it up in fine and fancy words, but that's what he said. I cannot think of anything more chilling than a sitting Supreme Court justice saying that, oh, yes, if somebody dies because of that, that's just like shouting fire in a crowded theater, and by God, their rights ought to be curtailed. I am absolutely livid over the idea that a sitting Supreme Court justice would even entertain that notion, let alone be on national TV with George Stephanopoulos opining that was the case. I am ready to chew nails. This man has absolutely no business talking about the First Amendment that way. And if that's how he truly feels, then he ought to recuse himself over every First Amendment issue that comes up. Because he has already said, oh gosh, peripheral deaths count against the First Amendment, and somebody ought not to be able to do that. Now, I'm not a barn burner. I typically don't do that kind of thing. But if somebody wants to burn a Koran or a Bible, if somebody wants to burn a flag, then yeah, they've got a right. Do I think that's right? No, you know, geez, there's a whole lot of other ways to make your point. But the fact that he decides to opine that because of a death, that whole concept of First Amendment rights ought to go out the window is absolutely astonishing. And I can't think of anything worse that could happen. He really, absolutely, and truly ought to recuse himself from any First Amendment case that he hears or that comes before the Supreme Court. He ought not to be allowed, I mean, he can express that opinion, but he's one of the nine that get to say Here's what the law says. He is one of the nine that gets to say, oh, this is good, that is bad. And that simply has absolutely no place in our jurisprudence. No place at all. If you want to hear some more about that, my guess is he's probably up on YouTube. My further guess is that you can go to Hot Air and you can take a look at what some other people had to say about that. I'm sorry, that just doesn't make it for me. Okay, so now that I got that out from underneath it, me, we can go on to the primaries. Oh boy, the primaries. The primaries are really kind of interesting tonight in that we have in Christine O'Donnell a winner. She has been called the winner. She has 53 with 100% of the precincts reporting. Now remember that 100% of the precincts reporting does not count absentee ballots, doesn't count mailed-in ballots, that kind of thing. But with 100% of the people that actually voted today, she's got 53.1% of the vote. She leads by about 2,500 votes, something really close to that. That is probably a lead that Mike Castle cannot overcome. Mike Castle has been in there forever. I mean, he is not a newcomer to this, but he skated. He is a very liberal Republican, voted with Pelosi on cap and tax. That's the thing that I remember him most about. Doesn't think it's a great idea to repeal the health care bill. He's saying at this point, well, gosh, you know, if we ever get a Republican president, maybe we'll think about repealing it then. And I'm saying, well, that's a little bit late, my friend. Way too late. In Massachusetts, we have challenging brawny flanks, Sean Bilat. Sean has got 64.2% of the vote. With 6,861 votes over Earl Scholey to challenge Barney Frank in the general election. That's going to be a really interesting race, and we're going to see how that kind of plays out. In Maryland, you got Barbara Mikulski, longtime Democrat operative. Got a ton of votes. She's got 73,000 votes. Looks like either Wargotz or Rutledge are the ones that are going to challenge her. So we'll see how that goes. For governor, we've got Robert Ehrlich versus Martin O'Malley. That is a repeat. So, again, that's another one that we're going to see how that works. Don't know that that's going to do it. Maryland is a very blue state. So we'll see. I don't know. New York, you know what? I'm kind of... Doug Hoffman has got a 50.6 lead over Matthew Doheny, who has 49.4. That one is going to be a real nail-biter, and we've only got 6.6% of the precincts reporting. So I'm not sure how that one is going to work out. Rhode Island, looks like John Laughlin is going to carry the banner for Republicans, David Cicilline, for the Democrats in District 1, District 2, Mark Zachariah, handily winning. John Langevin is going to be his opponent, and we'll see how that works out. John Robitaille is going to go up against Frank Caprio. I have to tell you, I am not any kind of an expert on what's happening in the upper northeast. I don't know. Wisconsin District 1, Paul Ryan, uncontested, you know, that's probably good. Chad Lee is hanging on to a one-point lead over Pete Theron for the Republican side. Dan Kopanky, handily beating Bruce Evers, so we'll see how that works. Dan Sebring is at 55% over Kenneth Lipinski. Again, we'll see how that one goes. Jim Sensenbrenner was uncontested, so there aren't any vote totals. Same is true of District 6 for Wisconsin. District 7, Sean Duffy looks like he's going to take that. And looks like Reed Ribble is going to be doing that for the Republicans in Wisconsin District 8. So that kind of gives you a little bit of a rundown as to what's going on there. On the Senate side for Wisconsin, looks like Ron Johnson is going to go up against Russ Feingold, and boy, I sure wish him a lot of luck in that. I'd sure like to see Feingold get out of there. Scott Walker has got 51% of the vote for Wisconsin governor, and again, that's one that I'm sure hoping that he is able to pull out. I gotta tell you, I don't know. So let me go back a little bit to Justice Breyer, because Ed Morrissey has got a bid on that. And basically, you know, he says that the fire in a crowded theater is intended to limit government intrusion on free speech, but does not enable an expansion of it. So if no one prosecutes a person who yells fire when it's really on fire, or when the person yelling honestly believes it to be so, then what kind of a deal do you have there? Nobody ought to put the government in charge of judging the qualitative value of any speech at all. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. If you said, for instance, oh, I think we ought to invade Pakistan, would that fall under that? I don't know. I mean, if the government can qualitatively say yes or no, then it seems to me like they've intruded into the idea of free speech pretty largely there. The Supreme Court has already ruled on Burnings' free speech. Free speech trumps any offense and or concerns about public safety raised by burning the American flag. So if the government can't get involved in that, then why in the world would it want to get involved, or why should it get involved in some other aspect of it? I mean, it doesn't seem to make any sense to me at all. So I'm not sure exactly why Justice Breyer said, there may not be a right to burn a Koran in the First Amendment. But if that's true, I'm sorry, then the government can control whatever aspect of speech that they would like to. And that just that just is not tolerable. Now, I don't know if you'd have people rioting in the streets or anything like that, All I'm saying is this. If the government can tell you what free speech consists of, then they can tell you what free speech you can have. And if they decide in their infinite wisdom that, oh, criticism of any administration, that Democrat, Republican, Freeper, I mean, I don't care, any administration, if any speech against it is declared to be, oh, contrary to the public good, and therefore is limitable, then where do you go from there? I mean, you got the highest court in the land saying, oh, no, we can't allow that. And all of a sudden, government has told you what you can say, what you can think. Well, maybe not quite think yet. But they can certainly tell you what you can say, and they can certainly tell you what you can do in terms of free speech. And that is not anything that I think that we ought to be feeling any kind of good about at all. So, there you go. That's kind of my take on all of that. I don't have any callers. If somebody wants to call in and talk about those things, we could do that. I had a request earlier today by Louisa Maw to talk about a $60 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Now, I don't know what all is included in that. Let me just point out that America has sold arms around the world for a very long time. Now, I can understand how people would be a little nervous about selling arms to a nation, any nation, that supports Sharia law, that reportedly has financed mosques and madrasas here in the United States, that has purportedly financed the expansion of Islam around the world, and furthermore, reportedly financed the murderers that flew their planes into the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. I can understand that. But to single this out and say, oh, that's obviously bad, kind of begs the question as to, well, okay, what did we sell them? How much of each? Is that good or bad for our own defense establishment? So it seems to me that that maybe we ought to hold off on judgment on that. Maybe we ought to say, yeah, okay, let's take a look at that. I mean, I'm not saying ignore it, not a bit. But if the only indication is, oh gosh, we ought to oppose any arms sale anywhere, we're going to find it hard-pressed to buy arms for our own military. Because, like it or not, our munitions builders, whether that's airplanes, tanks, uniforms, whatever, depend a lot on sales to foreign countries. So, we can say, oh gosh, now that's an unmitigated bad. Or we can say, yeah, you know, let's take a look at this. I'm not sure where we go with this. I'm not sure, do we have a bad thing happening? We got a neutral thing happening. We got a good thing happening. All I'm saying is, let's wait. Let's withhold judgment and say, okay, let's just wait and see before we say, oh, we've got a really bad thing here. Okay? That's just where I am on it. Your mileage may vary. If you want to say, oh, yeah, that's always a bad thing, then fine, that's good. I'm okay with that. All I know is that our defense contractors rely a lot on foreign sales. And if we don't have those foreign sales, then maybe that's not really a great thing. So, that's kind of where we are with all of that. Let's see what we might have going any place more on. Now, I already told you about DeVal Patrick and Charlie Baker. I'm kind of looking for Benishek, and I'm not sure where he is. I know he's running in the house, but I'm not finding that. If anybody has got some kind of an idea as to where I might find him, or what state he's actually running in, if you could maybe shout it out on Twitter or whatever, that would be like a really good thing. Okay? So I'm kind of done-ish in terms of where we are for topics to cover. I'm willing to talk about just almost any old thing and see what happens. If somebody wants to call in, then, you know, please do so. Just hang on here just a second, and I'll give you a call-in number. It is 646-652-2828. Further to the primaries, remember that these are primaries. Basically, these are intra-party fights. And we're trying to say, okay, who's going to represent the Republicans? And for the Democrats, it's who's going to represent the Democrats. But these are intra-party fights. These are not inter-party fights. And so we're going to get a lot of chatter and a lot of talk by the talking heads and the pundits and all of those folks about, oh gosh, are the Democrats imploding or are the Republicans imploding? And what does all this mean? Good gracious me, I don't know what to think. Well, it's an intra-party fight. We're trying to figure out where is the Republican, for those of us on the conservative side, where is the Republican Party going to go? I'll tell you my take on that. My take is this. If we are in fact in a fight for the heart and soul of the Republican Party, then I think that you have to look at where is the Tea Party. Now, everybody makes a big deal about the Tea Party. Democrats have tried dirty tricks with it. Some people have tried to claim it as their own. But you know what? The Tea Party really is we the people. And they're going to be all over the lot. And some have said, oh, well, that's their greatest strength. And others have said, yes, but that's also their greatest failing. And I'm telling you this, you are never going to go wrong, ever, by betting against we the people. You may be able to shut them up for a while. You may be able to marginalize them for a while. You may be able to make them not count for a while. You may be able to divide them and make them fight amongst themselves for a while. But eventually, we the people speak. And we do so pretty unequivocally. I think it's interesting to note, whether you look at generic polls or whether you look at specific races, independents flock to the Republican challenger. They particularly flock to the Republican challenger if that challenger enunciates, clearly articulates, a principled conservative position. I mean, it's one thing to say, oh gosh, we have these deficits. And oh gosh, wasn't healthcare a terrible thing? And oh gosh this, and oh gosh that. But if you articulate a principled conservative position, people will flock to that. They will come to that. They will vote for that. It's not magic. It isn't alchemy. It's simply people are tired of people saying one thing and doing another. Now, a word of warning to Republicans in the GOP. If you go back to Bush's tax and spend, if you go back to, and his famous statement, I had to destroy the free economy to save it, if you go back to that kind of behavior, the Tea Party will repudiate you. Now, I'm sorry, the Tea Party will refudiate you in a heartbeat, because I don't think that people are going to stand for that anymore. What was the lesson that we learned? What was it, 94? 94, we took back with Newt Gingrich and his Contract for America. We took back the House and the Senate. Took them back. People threw out the Democrats. And then what happened? We frittered that away. Absolutely frittered it away. And we frittered it away because Republicans weren't principled. They did not stand on principle. They did not fight the fights that they should have fought. They caved in and they said, oh, well, we have to go along to get along. You do not have to go along to get along. Democrats approved that forever. That's just nonsense. You don't have to do that. Don't do that. Because I will tell you this. Regardless of the magnitude of the landslide in 7 weeks, 49 days, if you do not live up to the promises that have been made and the statements that have been made, if you go back to the same old, the same I got to go along to get along, you will lose. Either one, conservatives will stay home, sit on their hands and say, you know what, folks? There isn't a dime's worth of difference between any of you. I'm not voting. And everybody will decry that poor turnout. Oh, gosh, if they had just come out to vote, they would have been fine. You know what? If I do not have a principled person running for that office, I'm not voting for him, ever. I will no longer, ever again, vote for the lesser of two evils. One's just quick suicide versus slow death. It doesn't make a bit of difference. And I'm not going to do that anymore. And I hope you're not going to do that anymore. We need to hold our politicians accountable. We need to say, this is what you said on the campaign trail. You know, that's one of the things that hasn't happened with Barack Obama. He said all kinds of things about postpartum, about working together, and all of that kind of stuff. And what did we get? We got the most partisan president that you can have. And I will tell you, GOP, if you do the same thing, we will turn on you in a heartbeat. We will tell you, nope. That isn't what I signed up for. It isn't what I am going to support, period. So, if you want to, say, well, we have to win, then I will tell you this. Who do you want to win with? Delaware is a great example of that. Is O'Donnell flawed? Absolutely. Absolutely no question in my mind that she's flawed. Is she more conservative and principled than Mike Castle? Again, not a doubt in my mind. Absolutely. So do you want to win with Mike Castle, who at best is going to be with you 52% of the time? Or do you want to go with an actual conservative and say, win, lose, or draw, here's my person. And if it doesn't happen this time, it'll happen next time. But I am not going to tolerate a rhino again, ever. Arkansas Traveler asked me, what about Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas? You know, the last I looked at that, Trav, she was not doing really good in the polls. And so I'm looking at that and saying, you know what? We're going to make progress there. I think she's going to lose. And that's going to be another Senate seat that goes for us. Now, are we going to take the Senate? I don't know. God, that's a long shot. I mean, that is truly a long shot. Are we going to improve our position greatly? Yes, we are. Absolutely. And then we aren't going to have to depend on the Olympia Snows and the Voinoviches and the Collins. Incidentally, those are the three that sold us out this time on that small business bill. Thank you very much, folks. Let's talk a little bit about the small business bill. I know, I'm jumping all over here, but you know what? All of these things are important, and you got to talk about them. The small business bill says, oh gosh, we're going to do great things, and we're going to provide tax breaks and credits for small business, and we're going to get lenders lending to small business. I got to tell you, I don't know what they're defining small business as, but I can tell you this. Oh, and by the way, that's all paid for. And you're saying, well, hooray, they finally got the message. You're going to pay for something. And I'm telling you, yeah, right, sure, except that what they're doing is they're paying for it with taxes on other businesses. Now, how dumb is that? Oh, gosh, I'm going to give it to you over here, and I'm going to take it away from you over there. Gee, left pocket, right pocket. Big whooping deal. That makes no sense at all. I mean, none. Think about that. We're going to give tax breaks to these small businesses. Now, is that important? Yeah, absolutely. Depends on if it's an actual tax break. And actually, you know, I'm getting a little tired of that, but I'll go back to that later. Depends on if it's an actual tax break or is it a tax credit. Because you know what? In order to take advantage of a credit, you have to have made some money. I don't know of a lot of small businesses that are doing that right now. I see more small businesses going out of business than I do making a profit that they can be taxed on and therefore apply a tax credit to it. Doesn't make sense. I'm gonna give these people over here a tax break, but I'm going to take it away from these businesses over here. And so you net, you wind up with the same thing. Net. Credit to a business over here, debit to a business over there. All balances out, all paid for. Everybody thinks, oh gosh, yeah, we've done great things here. But no, we haven't. We just went from the left pocket to the right pocket. That's all we did. And let me tell you why I have a problem with tax breaks. Tax breaks imply that the government owns it all. And they will give you a break so that you get to keep some of it. Now, one, that's not the free market. Two, it isn't capitalism. And three, I don't think the government has a higher claim on my resources or your resources or anybody's resources than you do. Or I do, or they do. I mean, what is it? You know, the old joke about the two-line income tax return. How much did you make? Send it in. No, that isn't how it works. We pay taxes, and if you want to think of it this way, we pay taxes for a product. That product is government. But, according to our Constitution, that is a limited government. They've got, 17 clearly delineated functions that they can operate in. They ought to collect taxes for those 17 clearly delineated items that they can operate in. If they are collecting more taxes than that, then they're doing something wrong. Stop and think about this. I had this conversation on Twitter the other day. And I said, you know, there is really something wrong with the idea that we're going to tax the states, the people in the states, and then we're going to give money back to those same states and people. There's something the matter with that idea. And here's what's the matter with it. One, some states are going to get more than what they paid in. Two, some states are going to get less than what they paid in. And three, if it is a constitutionally defined, if it is a constitutionally defined subject for the federal government, then what are they doing in education? What are they doing in Environmental Protection Agency? I mean, stop and think about this. We send a lot of money to Washington so that they can turn around and send it back to us. I sit on a committee here in Trinity County. It's called the Community Development Block Grant Loan Committee. And I'm about ready to get off of it. It used to be that we, Trinity County, received these CDBG funds. And we had some discretion as to who got them, for what purposes, and that kind of thing. Now, these are all low-income, substandard housing kinds of funds. So we had some discretion. Let me tell you that we had a meeting yesterday morning, Monday morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. And the first 9 items on the agenda were all, quote, loans. And they went to people from $1,000 a month income. By the way, that's one that I would have said, yeah, we need to do something for this person. All the way up to somebody who was making $41,000 a year. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't make $41,000 a year. I don't come close to that. Well, I come kind of close to it, but I don't make $41,000. And I'm saying, you know what? This person just got a 30-year loan, no payments, interest deferred, so he basically got free money. I mean, after 30 years, what does he care? Doesn't. No rational person would. So my ultimate question is this. Why in the world are we sending money to the federal government from the state of California? Every other state does the same, but I'll talk about California. Why are we sending money from California to the federal government so they can send it back to us in the form of CDBG funds, by the way, taking their cut off at the top? Why are we doing that? First off, why don't we just keep the money here in California to begin with? And then let's prioritize where the funds ought to go from there. Now, yes, I know. California is a dysfunctional state. Absolutely, truly is. But there's other states that aren't. And that would apply to them. Right? So why do we do that? Why do we do that with Department of Energy? I mean, Department of Energy started under Carter, for God's sake. And we have a greater dependence on foreign oil now than we did then. So what in the hell did all of that money do for us? All of that money that we collected, sent off to the federal government so they could send it back to whomever, and we're more dependent on foreign oil than we are today. What did that do for us? Anything? I mean, maybe there's a benefit, but I'm sure not seeing it. I don't know where it is. So, those are the things that you got to think about. Excuse me. Those are the things that you have to say, you know what, maybe there's not a good argument for that. Maybe we need to cut back the federal government, and maybe we need to keep those dollars in our own states, and then maybe we can prioritize what those dollars ought to be spent on in our own state. I mean, it's just a thought. Maybe you can come up with something better. Maybe you have an idea in your own state how those funds ought to be prioritized. I mean, I know that I do here in California. Maybe in your state, you're saying, well, yeah, we want to keep those dollars. We want to spend them on X, whatever X is. Then all you have to do is convince your local politicians. You don't have to go back to Washington, be called a lobbyist, and beg and plead for your own damn money. So, those are some thoughts on that. You need to think about that too. And here's where I tie this together. I know that Dems don't think that way. As far as they're concerned, all of the money is theirs. So that just leaves conservatives and Republicans. Republicans I don't trust so much. I mean, I hear and talk to a lot of Republicans, some of whom are actually conservative, but some of whom are, I call them Dem-lite. I'm sorry, they just, they really got this thing about, oh gosh, yeah, we have to help this person, and we got to help that person, and we got to do this, and we got to do that, and we got to do the next thing, none of which are contained in the Constitution. So it's a lonely fight, but it's one worth waging. And it's one that we, the people, through the Tea Party and other means, have successfully waged in various places. Joe Miller in Alaska, Christine O'Donnell up in Delaware. Maybe Sharon Angle over Reed. Are any of these people flawless? No, they are not. People are people, and people are flawed. That's the way of the world. You aren't going to get around that. But are they flaws that you can work with? Are they honorable people that keep their word? Do they stand on principle? Or do they blow with the wind? Or is there principle? It all belongs to me. I'll let you keep some of it. Now, I don't have a lot of patience with, it all belongs to me. I'll let you keep some of it. I have even less patience. Well, no. I don't have a lot of patience with people who are not principled, people who blow with the wind, people who need to focus group test stuff. Got a principle? Fine, state it. If I agree with it, we're good. If we don't, I'll try and persuade you. If you aren't persuadable, I'm going to start looking around. So I find somebody that I can either persuade or that has that principle. Principles, plural. And they're really pretty simple. Keep your word. Don't say one thing to get elected and do something else. Barack Obama's big problem. Said one thing trying to get elected, got himself elected, doing something else. Something completely, totally opposite. You know, I think the thing that scares me the most about him is we live in the greatest nation on earth. Come help me transform it. I'm sorry. You live in the greatest nation of earth and you want to transform it? You want to change that to something that isn't recognizable? Why in the world would you do that? And why in the world would a plurality of Americans agree with that? It makes no sense. Unless you don't have principles. If you don't have principles, yeah, that makes sense. Gosh, what am I going to get? 47% of the people of the United States of America do not pay taxes. Those 47% of the people want more stuff. Should they get more stuff? I think they ought to go out and get a job. Yeah, I know, jobs are in short supply. But you know what? I don't know about anybody else's community, but here in my community, the saying is, everybody that wants to work is working. The corollary to that is, those folks who don't want to work aren't working. And they're living off the system. Now, if you got a good gig, you keep it, right? I mean, everybody's that way. We're all people. You got a good thing going, what do? You don't throw it away. But the idea that you can make a living off of somebody else, that you can take somebody else's hard-won, hard-worked-for gains and appropriate them for your own use, I'm sorry, that's absolutely foreign to me. I'm sorry. It just, that doesn't work. Ever. Under any circumstances. You can't do that. And yet, 47% of the people in the United States don't pay taxes. A large number of them get money back. Child credits, working credits, all kinds of credits. But you know what? Those are paid in cash. We are now, 1 in 7 Americans are now officially labeled poor. Now, I've got some problems with that. My problems are this. When you say poor, what do you mean? Do you mean they're poor like poor in India? Where they stake out their 1 foot by 3 foot or 4 foot section of sidewalk to sleep on? Are they poor as in Bangladesh? Are they poor as they're poor in Sudan? No. I mean, I don't think you can go any place here in the United States of America and see that kind of poverty. And you know what? There's no crime or sin in being poor. I mean, I don't know what my folks made when I was a kid growing up. But I'll tell you this. We may have scrimped and saved. And no, we didn't get everything that we wanted for Christmas. But we always had clean and neat clothes to go to school in. We always had food on the table. Might not have been a lot of it, but there was food on the table. We always had a roof over our head. We always had heat and light. And the folks always had one car, at least, that they were somehow able to keep gas in. Now, if that's poor, well, okay, I guess we were poor. But we were happy. Well, as happy as one guy could with three other siblings. But nevertheless, here's my point. When you say poor, usually in our minds, that evokes an image. And it evokes the image of that Pakistani or that Indian or that Sudanese. And we say, oh, my God, that's terrible. But you know what? Our poor live better than the upper middle class of any other country on earth. So when we say, yep, 1 in 7 Americans are poor, and by the way, that's a reason that we have to keep these government programs going, I'm telling you, wait a second, stop, slow down, let's think about this, and let's make sure that we're talking about the same kind of poor as the picture you want in my mind of poor. Because that's not what poor is in America. Are there people that go to bed hungry? I am sure there are. Are there kids that go to bed hungry? I am sure there are. But then you have to ask yourself, wait a second, was that because of choices their parents made? I mean, if they're a kid, they weren't their choices. Right? So maybe it was the choices that the parents made. I'm not going to get into that whole subject of drug use and alcohol and all that kind of stuff. I'm not going there. All I'm saying is this. We have to be really careful about how we use the word poor. And we have to make sure that the mental picture actually coincides with what actually is poor in America. And then we have to look at what were the choices that were made. Did the folks go out and buy, I don't know, candy bars, ice cream, instead of good food? Did they go out and buy prepared meals instead of fixing meals, which are lower cost? I mean, why is that happening? Now, government would tell you, oh, well, it's happening because we don't have enough programs in place. And I'm saying, wait a second, stop. You've got plenty of programs in place, but you aren't administering them very well. We've had a war on poverty since when? LBJ, 1963. War on poverty. We have waged that war relentlessly through today. And where are we? Same place we were then. We haven't changed. People haven't changed. Results haven't changed. Choices haven't changed. And the consequences of poor choices have become ameliorated because there's always a government program. And if there is always a program, how do you teach people, and you know what? You made a bad choice. I'm sorry you made a bad choice. There are philanthropies, there are churches, there are all kinds of organizations, private organizations out there that will help you. Go see them. Do not come to the federal or the state government. And folks say, Bill, you're heartless. And I'm saying, you know, not really. What's the saying? Give a man a fish and he'll eat today. Teach a man how to fish and you fed him forever. Same thing holds true. You teach them about their choices. And you know what? If it gets bad enough, take their damn kids away from them. Because the kids grow up thinking that's normal behavior. And it isn't. It is dysfunctional, destructive behavior. And if you leave them there, that is what they will learn. That is why we have third and fourth generations on welfare. Because they never learned that there was a different, better way to do this. So we need to educate them. We need to say, hey, you know what? When you make bad choices, you get consequences. And here are what those consequences are. And yes, if you don't listen to me, and if you don't take those lessons to heart, then you know what? You're going to suffer those consequences. Now, we are going to ameliorate that for your kids, but we aren't going to save you. You're an adult. You're responsible for yourself. Make better choices. And if you can't, then you're the one who's going to suffer the consequences. And if that means taking their kids away from them, I'm up for that. I'm okay with that. Put them in an environment where they know and understand what choices and consequences are. That's not heartless. Actually, that's more loving than saying, oh, well, no, you really can't think for yourself. We'll take care of you. I don't want to be taken care of. I mean, there may come a point in my life when that's unavoidable. You know, age does that. But that's generally family. At least in my family it is. And I'm sure hoping it isn't some cool, clinical, impersonal, institutional setting. But the point of that is this. You make bad choices, you suffer the consequences, and we will not allow those consequences to impact that child. So we will take that child, we will put them in a good, warm, loving environment, and we will teach them and talk to them about choices and consequences, actions and reactions, how people are, how do you get ahead in life, what do you have to do, and send them to school. Preferably schools that are not funded by federal dollars. And that's a subject for a whole other night. I get upset when I start thinking about what Republicans and Democrats have done to the education system. Did you know? This is interesting. Did you know that in the mid-1800s, school children memorized the Iliad and the Odyssey, that they could speak Latin, that they were numerate, they were literate, and they were taught to think critically. And they did that with far fewer resources than we have today. And yet, what do we have? We have high school graduates that can neither spell nor read. We have college graduates that can't spell. Now, spelling isn't tough. Oh, yeah, okay, sure, so somebody's dyslexic. Fine, that's great. How many people like that are out there? Not the vast majority. And yet we have people that can't spell. We have people that do not have a basic grasp of mathematics. They can't tell the difference between medium and average. Don't understand that concept. We have people that are illiterate and innumerate, and we expect to get excellence out of that? I'm sorry, no. We don't get excellence out of that. Los Angeles had, running out of time here, folks, Los Angeles, LA Times, as a matter of fact, which surprised me, LA Times had an article, actually a series of articles, and they had information that they correlated, and I know that I've told this story before, but there's a point to it, that correlated student performance with teachers. And they identified the high-performing teachers. And what happened? Everybody jump up and down and say, dang, that's great. Geez, we need to copy that. We need to clone those people. We need to make sure that those kind of people are the ones that are teaching our kids. No, they did not say that. What they said was, well, the unions aren't going to like this. And the unions popped up and said, oh, my God, this is totally unfair. You've identified people that don't do well, and there's lots of reasons why they don't do well. And I'm saying, you know what? When you look at student achievement and you correlate that to the teachers, you have got a metric that you can use. And that is anathema to unions. That drives an absolute stake through their heart. Because the last thing they want to do is be held accountable. Accountability is like garlic is to vampires for them. You cannot hold them accountable, because if you do hold them accountable, you will see that what they do is protect their worst. And they inhibit their best. And that's just plain wrong. It is just plain wrong. Folks, that's it for tonight. Thank you for sitting through my rants. I appreciate that. Conservatives, stick together. Support those conservatives. Make sure that you do not vote for the lesser of two evils. Night now.